It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Mike Malevsky here at Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Who's on the line?
Why, it's Tom Begich here, Mike.
Tom Begich, thank you. I'm looking forward to this. So, where are you calling from?
Anchorage, Alaska. I've been out gardening, you know, doing my.
I like it.
Plants.
I like it. So are we. It's great. It's that time of year when that kind of activity can help us go on wherever we are. So I am, for listeners who don't know how we've done this in the past, I have often, toward the end of a legislative session or after that, asked for commentary from a variety of people who have some experience and can observe what we have watched through many media reports, but really may not still have an understanding of just what happened. So what we can say, what I can start off with, was, this legislative session finished a day early, did it not?
Yes, it did, much to the surprise of many, many observers. But that's what happens when you have fairly reasonable leadership in both the House and the Senate that can speak to each other. And it really does make a difference because it lowers the level of acrimony and, if you will, testosterone in the room. So.
Right. Now, what I understand, even though the session has ended, one of the major discussions throughout that session had to do with a combination of educational funding and, of course, the PFD. And while the session ended and there seemed to be agreement, there's still some breath holding. Explain to people how that can be. Yeah. How can that be?
Yeah, so you ended up with an agreement through most of the session. The Senate and the House leadership that is focused on education met with or talked to representatives of the governor's office and some outside folks as well, and tried to craft a compromise bill that would include some educational priorities, as well as an increase in what's called the base student allocation. That's the funding per student that we give out that has not been substantially increased since a vote back in 2014. And so, you know, we had a small increase with what was called the READS Act that passed in 2022, but that was only a very small incremental one. And by most accounts, anywhere from the BSA is underfunded anywhere from $1,000 to $1,850 by per student by most accounts. But what the House and Senate were auguring for was something north of an amount of money that was passed last year, which was $680 per student, one time money. And what they were trying to change the law so the law would increase the formula. And that's how we change it over time to keep track of inflation. We change the actual number. So they did do that. They reached a compromise between the House and the Senate, which they thought would be palatable to the governor, certainly was palatable to members of both the Senate and the House minorities as well, which is a real compromise. It's a real deal. So they passed what is an increase of $700 for the base student allocation, but they did some sweeteners as well. They added some funding for transportation, which has been woefully underfunded in the past, which affects Mat-Su, it affects Kenai, Anchorage, Fairbanks, some of the larger districts, Juneau, but also even some of the smaller ones like Bethel, which has transportation needs as well. And you have the transportation money was in there. There was some literacy grant money that was in there. There's some additional funding for voc education as well, but that money was tied to support of an internet tax bill, a bill that wouldn't pass on anything to the consumer, but would just do what every other state is doing and collect a fair share portion of internet tax. And that would have been designated, but you can't delegate it, but you can sort of say, this is where we want it to go. That would have funded the voc ed elements that the governor was asking for. So that's what happened, Mike. They the legislature came together, they passed the bill by a fairly substantial margin, and then there were, I think, three no votes in the Senate, and there were, I believe it was eight no votes in the House. The governor quickly vetoed that bill.
Oh.
He claimed that the bill didn't meet his conditions, didn't meet his desires. Though that's interesting because during the negotiations, virtually everything that the governor and the negotiators had agreed on were in that bill. Nonetheless, he did that. And then the legislature immediately came together in what's called a joint session when the House and the Senate meet together, and they voted and they overrode that veto. So they basically said, this is the new policy, this is the new statute, and it will be a $700 increase to the base student allocation. And, you know, they thought that would be the end of it, but it's not.
And it's because?
He will likely, but the governor also has line item veto over the budget. So
right.
What he's likely to do is he's going to take that item, that line item, and he's likely to veto that number, that $700 number, down to something like $500 is what we're predicting he will do. So he's going to lower the amount just sort of as a way of saying, I didn't get everything I wanted, so you're not going to get everything you wanted. And unlike the base student allocation, which is a statute, when it comes to an actual revenue bill, a bill that deals with the budget directly, you have to have 45 of 60, not 40 of 60, to override the governor. And with absences and things like that, the odds of the legislature making that decision before January is a 0 to 0. It's not going to happen.
So the reality then for people who are working in districts all over the state is that they can begin the next year thinking, okay, what happens? Scenario A, the legislature in January does not override that. Meanwhile, we're already down the road in our budget for this year.
That's right.
Or they do override it, and that's great, but now we have to run to catch up because we may have reduced the number of people we've employed or one thing or another.
Both are true. If I were so there's a couple of things. You know, the legislature passed on to, or I believe it was today that they passed on the budget bill to the governor. He has 20 days minus Sundays to make his vetoes known. At that point, you get the real number. So you don't even know what the real number is. I'm speculating it's $500. Maybe he'll be persuaded by the recent move by a number of superintendents and leave it at 700. But at the very least, if you're a school district or, you know, a superintendent or a financial officer in a school district, you got to be thinking about that because you got to be thinking, well, you know, I can't make a guessing game with people's employment. I have to be prudent because that's, you know, my charge in this job. So I'm going to be prudent. I'm going to anticipate that he could veto all of that money. We are exactly where we are now, you know, next year. And then assuming the governor only narrows, the, you know, only vetoes 200 of that $700, then we can immediately try rehiring. And that already puts us behind the game. Teachers are leaving. People who
sure.
thought they had jobs are looking for jobs elsewhere now. And, you know, that's the problem. But that's the issue. And then once you know the final number, let's say we know that by the end of June, or we certainly should know by the end of June, mid-June. You know that that number, let's call it 500, then you can immediately plan the best what your budget will be for the coming year. You can plan on it, but not until you know what that final number is. And you don't know, and you shouldn't speculate that they're going to override. They need 45 votes. They only had 46 on the full bill override. But when it comes to, you know, 8 months of time gone by, 7 months of time gone by, and then you're
sure.
looking at a new fiscal cliff or whatever it may be, you don't know if you're going to have 46 votes. So the school district should not be planning on that. They should be planning on whatever the number is the governor gives in mid-June when he finally gives out his vetoes.
Okay.
Let's go to zero, sorry.
Mike Malevsky here at Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska, and I'm speaking with Tom Begich. former Alaska State Senator, Minority Leader in the Senate. Tom, we started out by talking about this education bill, and wrapped up in there was that second part, which is the PFD. And that number, it contributed to the budget being balanced at a certain level. And how big a role did the PFD number play in this whole thing?
Well, if the PFD, the governor introduced, so the statute for the PFD, just like the statute for the BSA, says it will be a certain amount, but the courts have ruled that the governor has the right to, or the legislature has the right to lower that number below what the statute requires. So, but there is consensus now in the Senate and the House that there needs to be a permanent fund dividend check. So they set the amount at $1,000, which was apparently a rounded number that allowed the Senate and the House to come together with what is a very, very small surplus, $57 or $58 million, I can't remember the exact number, a surplus, that, and which is by the Constitution, they're required to have a balanced budget. So having a surplus is fine. If they had taken that $57 million and dumped it into the dividend check, you would have had an addition of 10 or 20 bucks to the dividend. So they just did the rounded number. That also helps them plan for contingencies. The difference between ignoring the statute under the PFD and ignoring the statute under the education funding is that the Constitution speaks to maintaining an education budget. It does not speak to maintaining a dividend. So the courts may view ignoring that new statute very, very differently than they would look at ignoring the PFD statute. The two are tied together. No matter what you do, in the long run, this legislature and the governor are going to have to come to an agreement on what a reasonable amount to pay for the PFD is, because our Constitution is clear. It speaks to education first and foremost.
Right. Okay.
Well, so that's the conundrum here is both statutes are going to be ignored, but one statute is probably stronger than the other.
Well, in preparation for our conversation, I turned to a source that I have found useful in the past, and that is Alaska Landmine, and particularly Brad Keithley and his continuing discussion. He's been doing this for a long time about the PFD. And in his most recent article, he basically was taking to task those people who had wanted to take the two funds and join them together. And as usual, he did a fairly extensive explanation of why that was the wrong thing to do, and that basically there's some accounting issues that could be used to still inflation-proof the corpus, but leave cash available. Are you familiar with his arguments or discussion?
Yeah, it's so funny. I actually not only read it, but was talking to a state senator yesterday and asked them to read it.
There we go.
So one of the things here that people should know is that we are statutorily required to inflation-proof the fund, but we don't always do that either.
Right.
There's a habit here. What Mr. Keithley points out is that you could use basically on the unearned income, not the unearned, but the unrealized income of the earnings of the earnings reserve, to literally cover the inflation-proofing component and still maintain a reasonable balance in the budget. He particularly points out that if you merge the what's called the earnings reserve account, which is the both the real and realized and unrealized earnings from the principal of the permanent fund, if you get rid of that account, you lose the flexibility you would have to be able to both inflation proof as well as tap the what's called percent of market value. And why that matters is, so I had always been persuaded by this merger concept. It was a very persuasive concept, mix the two funds together, guarantee a dividend of a certain amount that, you know, probably is indexed to something, inflation or percentage. And then you have, a large sum of money that, effectively about $5 billion right now, you're $4 billion. But $84 billion that you could then, you know, tap for both, you know, spending for government and spending for the dividend and maintaining your income. But what Keith Lee points out is that if you do that, you open the door to basically eventually having to go into the principal that's protected today of the permanent fund. And for me, and going all the way back to Jay Hammett, that's like a is an absolute red line. The principal is sacrosanct. You
right.
actually should not do that. So his argument is leave the earnings reserve present, look at this other accounting method and see if you can't apply it, because you should be able to, and just take a reasonable look at it. So I actually said to my wife, Sarah, yesterday, I need to sit down with this guy and talk to him a little bit more, figure out what's going on here, because it was very persuasive, and I would encourage people to go to that article in the Alaska Landmine. I really would.
Now, what I also did, I sometimes go further down the screen to look at comments, and there was one comment that reflected, if you will, kind of a pushback against people who are pretty much against raising taxes of any sort by referencing the state of Florida. And again, it was in the comment, I'm presuming, and it may be accurate or somewhat close to, that the state of Florida provides funds for its operation. 63% of its operation is provided by the state income tax in Florida.
Yeah, because they have an income tax.
Right. So the question of, and I think that was referenced there in that comment, to say even somewhat conservative places, Florida might fit in that category, they have found a value in using an income tax for government. And, of course, the arguments have been swirling around that if Alaska had retained it or had it, then you would feel more ownership than just deriving funds from the permanent fund. Do you have any sense of any of the potential for taxes of one sort or another being added to the income stream?
Well, yes and no. So the yes part is the legislature did pass a what would have been about a $65 million is the estimate tax. This was the tax on internet sales, which would is not passed on to the consumer. That's a tax that is just collected by the state in which the sales are made. That will likely be vetoed by the governor. The legislature is very close to passing what was Rob Yunt's bill to fill the loophole of what's large S corps that are dodging the tax. What they're doing, these S corporations, which is a type of private corporation, are exempt from any kind of corporate income tax, which we actually have on the books. So a company like, say, ConocoPhillips sells its assets to a company like, well, in this case, it was actually BP, sells their assets to a company, and they're paying money, and they sell their assets to a company that's an S corp. Suddenly, the S corp benefits because they don't pay taxes on all that once taxable income. Only change is the ownership. Nothing changed in terms of how much they were taking advantage of the state's infrastructure, et cetera, but now they're not subject to a tax. So the S-Corp tax was to fill that, Senator Yunt called the unfairness of that tax structure. You know, because a company like Hillcorp, which doesn't pay any of that tax, can literally continue to acquire companies that do pay that tax and take that money off the books. And that makes it harder and harder for the state to function. So what that bill would do would be to fill that loophole, and the estimates were that it would generate between $100 and $165 million. So now you're talking about $230 million. That's enough to have paid for the increase to the base student allocation, interestingly enough. So now there's also the what's called the per-barrel tax credit, a change made, you know, a decade and a half ago, two decades ago, I guess now, that changed our tax structure to benefit the oil industry. That per-barrel tax, even Governor Dunleavy's Department of Revenue said that it could be lowered from $8 per barrel credit to a $5 per barrel credit for the oil company without significantly hurting any of the oil companies or their investment strategies. And that would generate anywhere back in the day, it would have generated around $500 million. But now it would probably generate between $100 and $200 million. So now you're talking about just in those taxes, not even talking personal income or personal sales or an education head tax. So all of those are in the works right now. Here's the problem. The president administration is not going to support a tax of any kind. Doesn't matter what the exigency is, they're not going to do it. And all three of those taxes actually don't directly impact any Alaskan citizen. So if your issue is that I don't want to be taxed, you shouldn't mind these three taxes that would generate potentially close to $700 million. So putting that aside, there's also the issue of why aren't we paying any taxes outside of property taxes in the state, or where there is, like in your area, a sales tax of some kind used for local government. Well, we ought to seriously be talking about that. And we have talked about it in the past. I've proposed bills when I was in the Senate that address that. But, you know, Alaskans can and should take, you know, a little bit of interest in how we build our state. And that means knowing when you have the will, knowing that you can have an income tax. Now, under the past governor, under Governor Walker, there was an effort made by that state house to move an income tax. It got to the Senate when I was a freshman senator, and it died. But it at least got to the floor of the Senate.
Right.
It got 7 out of 20 votes. And there was a second tax that same time period that passed that was a education head tax. It would have put 10, you know, approximately, I think it was $50 on your first paycheck. And that would have been a one-time tax that would have been ideally earmarked for, though, you know, there's some technicalities around that, but earmarked for education. And that would have generated between 100 and 170 million, depending on how you structured it. But that went all the way up to the final committee of referral, which means the last committee that would hear it, which is the Rules Committee, before it got to the floor of the House, and then it never made it to the floor. So there are good ideas out there. One of the best income tax ideas was, let's just put 10, we'll just say 10% or 5% or 3% of whatever it is you pay in federal income tax will be paid as a state income tax, and some portion of that you'd then be able to write off in your federal income taxes. So really holding money you're paying anyway, holding a good portion of that money right here locally instead of sending it to Washington, where you might not even agree, with what the country does with that money.
Right.
So these were all options that were on the table, have been on the table, but you have to have, if you will, a trifecta. You have to have the will in the Senate, the will in the House, and the will in the veto pen to effectively get those policies in place. Until then, you have to stitch it all together with whatever thread you have. And that's why things like the internet tax or the S-corp loophole have to happen.
So it's somewhat impressive to me that a reasonably described as conservative senator, Rob Yount, in the minority in the Senate, was pushing this particular tax bill, the one you referenced earlier.
Rob is an independent. In many, many ways. He's his own guy.
Right.
And I had the good fortune of having a really very, very wonderful conversation with him in March when I was down there visiting and at his instigation, and we just far-reaching conversation. And what I got from that was, this is a guy who's devoted to fairness. And when he sees something that's not fair, he's going to act on it. He and I may not agree on a lot of things. And in fact, I got along quite well with David Wilson, Senator Wilson, who he ran against.
Right.
But what I saw in Rob was a person willing to listen. And you may have seen his daily Anchorage Daily News editorial on the education bill or heard his comments, which I did hear when that education bill finally passed the Senate in its final form. They were the kind of comments that, as a minority member, were the kind that made me a strong minority leader, because they reached out, they reached across the aisle to say, I know we disagree on virtually everything, but look, we found common ground here. Now, if we could just get, a few more people in the House and Senate thinking that way, modeling that behavior, things will change. But again, it comes down to the governor. You've got to have a governor who's willing to sign it, because 21 votes in the House, which is a majority, and 11 votes in the Senate, which is a majority, times zero, which is a governor's veto, is zero.
Got it. Well, we've covered a lot of ground, Tom, and we have a few minutes left. Thinking back over the session, are there other things that we want to highlight for listeners before we do finish up?
Well, I think the primary thing I would say, the thing that impressed me most about this legislative session, was even though there were moments of acrimony and moments of disagreement, I saw at least a number of times people, when they had disagreement, reaching out to others to try to figure out how to make it work. When there was some real acrimony happening in the state house, you know, the speaker and the minority leader Costello and Speaker Edgemond pulled back, talked it through, and then came back to a place where they could actually have a viable conversation, the freedom to think for themselves. This is so truly Alaskan, and to see us not buy into what is frankly the BS happening at the federal level is really, for me, is one of the greatest achievements of this legislature. Alaska does it differently. Those coalitions are unique. The ability of Republicans and Democrats to work together, that's unique. That's American. That's what we should be doing, and I saw a lot of that this session. But as far as policy goes, I think we've moved the education ball forward. We frankly are having the kinds of discussions about the budget we need to. Now it's just a matter of finding the will to accomplish those tasks.
Okay. Well, Tom, as usual, it's been an interesting ride. I'm happy you were able to be available to have this discussion, and I look forward
Gardening takes time, but
it's
always a chance to break.
Yeah.
But thank you, Mike.
You're welcome. Stay well out there, and we'll talk again.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.